From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. This week, the president in Texas and a crisis at the border, Israel and Hamas on the edge of war, spies and smallpox. On Wednesday in Dallas, President Obama addressed critics who asked why he has not gone to see the flood of children at the southern border.
This isn't theater. This is a problem. I'm not interested in photo ops. I'm interested in solving a problem.
Republicans look to hang the immigration crisis on the White House. Here's John Boehner.
This is a problem of the president's own making. He's been president for 5.5 years. When's he going to take responsibility for something?
And rockets out of Gaza and bombs in from Israel.
Funerals, clashes, airstrikes and rocket attacks. Tensions thick and black and growing ever more intense, beginning to be reminiscent of the dark, bloody days of the last intifada more than 10 years ago.
This hour on Point, our weekly news roundtable with Kevin Diaz of the Houston Chronicle, Nancy Youssef of McClatchy, and On Point news analyst Jack Beatty. You can join us on air or online, where this conversation is always on. What do you see at the border in Gaza and Israel, in that box full of smallpox? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Joining us now from Washington is Kevin Diaz, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Texas has been in the thick of the news this week. Kevin Diaz, welcome. Great to have you here.
Hello, Tom. Good to be here.
And with us from Washington, Nancy Youssef. She's national security correspondent for McClatchy and was their longtime Middle East correspondent. Nancy, welcome back to On Point. Wonderful to have you.
Hi, Tom. Great to be here.
And from Hanover, New Hampshire, Jack Beatty joins us. Hello, Jack.
Hello, Tom, Kevin, and Nancy.
Jack Beatty there in Hanover. Kevin Diaz, take us down to Texas, and what you see going on there right now. Is anybody describing accurately what's happening here? Does anyone have a solution, Kevin?
Well, there's no political solution. There's a growing consensus for some kind of a change in the law that makes an exception for children from Central America, from countries other than Mexico. That seems to be the only part of this controversy where there's any kind of agreement or more or less agreement. I shouldn't say everybody's in agreement, but there seems to be a growing consensus there.
Take us back to that law, 2008, signed by President George W. Bush. This was to protect children from human trafficking, but the effect is we've got, first of all, a flood coming over, and an ocean of kids building up now. They're saying 40, 50,000 already in this year. They're now saying, I think, there could be 90,000 that come over this year. What was this legislation passed for, Kevin Diaz?
Well, it was originally intended under the Bush administration to combat sex trafficking, and that's why it pertains to countries other than Mexico and Canada, where there's understood to be a different kind of migration going on. By the way, the law was in 2008. The policy had been in place even before that.
Mm-hmm.
The 2008 law just made it, you know, codified it. But the irony is, you know, the president's being blamed for not adhering to the nation's immigration laws. But the problem is that the administration actually has been adhering to at least that law. And that's obviously part of the problem here. That's part of the push.
You report that the waits for these kids to have their cases considered have become very long. El Paso, the longest in the country. Houston, you're out of Houston, 541 days before kids come before a judge to have their case considered in Houston. The Obama administration now trying to push the newcomers to the front of the line. Why, Kevin?
Well, because it's the center of attention right now. I think one thing that a lot of people aren't paying attention to is that by reallocation of judges and putting these cases front and center, moving them to the front of the line, that's pushing other cases from the interior of the country to the back of the line. And I'm sure most people who are listening who have been paying attention to the immigration issue realize that the Obama administration up until now has made a priority of deporting adults, particularly single adults and often people with records. So it's a little dicey here, you know, what the back end of this process is going to look like if we're going to make a priority of deporting children.
But all kinds of politics and urgency around this as kids pile up at the border. Rick Perry was determined to sit down with President Obama this time, not get the 30-second sort of shake-off he thought he got last time the president a few years back was in the state. On Wednesday, after meeting with President Obama, the Texas governor, Republican Rick Perry, talked with Fox News host Sean Hannity. Hannity asked Perry if the president was responsible for the crisis at the border.
Is he responsible?
Well, I think the policy, I mean, the nuances of the policies, when it's catch and release, when it's that if you're from another country outside of Mexico, then you're going to be treated differently and you can stay here for up to 2 years. Of course, those are messages that very quickly get transported back to Central American countries.
And catch and release. Of course, there's the law here, too, but there have been messages sent. On Wednesday in Dallas, President Obama said Congress needs to come together to help solve the border crisis.
The challenge is, is Congress prepared to act to put the resources in place to get this done? Another way of putting it, and I said this directly to the governor, is, are folks more interested in politics or are they more interested in solving the problem?
Well, a lot of politics this week, but also a very big problem. Here's Texas Senator John Cornyn, the Republican, Texas, criticizing the president's request for $3.7 billion to cope with the flood of immigrants, many children, from Central America.
What disappoints me so much with the president's request, he's asking for a blank check, in essence, $3.7 billion, but no reform. And I know that he knows, because it's been published and because of conversations with his key leadership, that he knows what he needs to do in order to address this problem. But he apparently, as a result of political calculations, is refusing to do that. And that's really very sad.
The president wants no reform, says Senator Cornyn out of Texas. Jack Beatty, this gets gnarly in a hurry. There was all kinds of reform on the table. It went nowhere on Capitol Hill. And yet the president being beaten up now for not going there. On the other hand, it was he who pushed to let the children of immigrants, illegal or otherwise, undocumented or otherwise, stay in the country. And some say that message went down to Central America as a green light.
Yes, and I've seen reporting on Telemundo saying just that, that coyotes in these countries, that is to say, traffickers, have been saying, have been talking about that law and saying, look, you can come to the U.S. and you'll become a citizen. You'll have virtual amnesty. So, yes, that's happened. But, you know, the president says, are people more interested in politics than solving problems? He has politics himself. It's not just as he's the neutral problem solver here. I was shocked that on Sunday, when his Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson was on TV, seven times he was asked, are these children going home? Should they go home? He said he dodged the question seven times. The message we have to send is, yes, they're going home, and they go home tomorrow if we could just change this law, which makes it past incredulity why the administration didn't include in its bill to Congress a change in that law. I watched the testimony at the Senate yesterday, and they said, oh, yes, we'll submit something, we want a change on the law. But what's the politics here? The politics is that the immigration rights people are saying to the president, oh, you can't do that. We have to show compassion for these kids. We can't. This is the politics of misplaced compassion. Compassion is to get the kids on the airplane, send them home, send the message, this is a waste of time, waste of money. Do not do this. That's the compassionate thing. And I'm afraid the president, by essentially submitting an incomplete bill, maybe they will eventually, there's a bill now in both houses, they're working on it, but it's as if he's playing the politics of his own immigrant and human rights groups at a moment when he's saying it's the Republicans who are playing politics.
Nancy Youssef, how about it? Is the compassionate thing to send them home? It may be the politically necessary thing in the United States, but we've heard on this show the stories coming out of Honduras and beyond, Guatemala, of terrible gang violence down there, of all kinds of poverty, of circumstances so bad that parents are putting their 7-year-old kids on a 1,000-mile journey practically alone. I mean, is it the compassionate thing to send them home, Nancy?
4-year-olds, toddlers being sent over, and send them home to whom and how? And how do you do that in such a responsible way? It's quite an onus to put on the United States government. We're talking thousands and thousands of children that need to be sent home, as they say. How do you do that? How do you do it responsibly? Right now, they're being held in a lot of cases at U.S. military installations, sleeping on the floor in groups, seeking some sort of protection. And the fact that parents would feel that it is better to put them in those circumstances than the ones that they were living in, it certainly begs the question. If such a decision would be compassionate, or in fact put them in a danger that now the United States would bear direct responsibility for, because it was the United States who took that initiative. So
some saying these are refugees. Kevin, 3.7 billion. Break that down for us. What would they do with that money if they got it? Congress, Republicans are saying blank check, no way. But if they got it, what's it for?
Well, even if they get it, about half of it, actually, I think one thing people aren't really paying attention to is more than half, well, a little less than half the money actually goes to the border enforcement, about 1.5 billion of that 3.7
border
for
patrol,
border enforcement.
All that, yeah.
Right. Yeah. The piece that's for housing and services for the kids is about 1.8 billion, I think it is. And interestingly, the part that really is the crux of the matter, which is beefing up the immigration courts, you know, where the backlog is, that only gets $64 million. So I don't know if they'll have to revise that. But I think one thing that I think a lot of people are forgetting here, we talk about changing this law. They could change that law tomorrow morning. And that doesn't mean that all these kids are going to go back on a bus tomorrow afternoon. There have been questions raised about ex post facto changes in the law. Even if they change the law now, it doesn't necessarily apply to the kids who are already here.
Wow.
And another thing to keep in mind is that a lot of these kids aren't being sent up by their parents. They're being called up by their parents. Their parents are already here. And that's one reason why some people think you're never going to see them in court later anyway.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're looking at a week in the news. Immigration crisis on the border, rockets and bombs in Gaza, Israel, American spies in Germany, smallpox in a cardboard box in Maryland. Kevin Diaz is with us, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Nancy Youssef is here, national security correspondent from McClatchy. Spent a lot of time covering the politics of the Middle East. Jack Beatty's here. You can join us as well. A lot of back and forth this week over whether the president should have gone to the border. He was in Colorado and then in Texas doing a lot of Democratic Party fundraising, was in Austin, Texas yesterday, not talking nearly as much about immigration. On Wednesday, Democratic Congressman Henry Cuellar of Texas called it bizarre that President Obama was not planning while he was down there to go on down to the border.
Under the circumstances, when he is shown playing pool in Colorado, drinking a beer, and he can't even go 242 miles to the Texas border, he either can roll up his sleeves and go down to the border, or he can just look aloof and detach and not go to the border, send surrogates down there and say that he's got everything under control.
Kevin Diaz, how do you read the politics of the president not going to border? Is this just kind of stubbornness? As people demanded that he go, he dug in to say no, or is there some other reason? Why not go?
Yeah, I agree with Cuellar. It's bizarre. I mean, I've been covering politics a long time in Washington. This one really makes me scratch my head. In Texas, members of Congress on both sides are calling this Obama's Katrina moment, comparing it to the famous photo of George W. Bush flying over New Orleans after the hurricane. I mean, I understand the logic. He's got the situation under control. He sent his top ministers there. It would just cause the chaos and traffic and get in the way. But let's face it, the presidency requires certain symbolic and theatrical elements, and he needs to be there.
But Jack, I mean, you know, the president has pushed for immigration reform. Maybe it would have addressed this if done in whole. We've got a big op-ed piece today from Bill Gates and Warren Buffett and Sheldon Adelson, of all trios, saying American citizens are paying 535 people, i.e. Congress, to take care of the legislative needs of the country, and they're not on immigration. Who's dropping the ball here, Jack?
Well, Congress has dropped the ball on immigration. I think there's only been one congressman defeated thus far this year. Who was it? Eric Cantor. Why was it? Because he made even halfway accommodating noises about helping the Dreamers. It was just the Republican primary voters threw him out.
So is it Congress or is it American voters who just don't want more over the border?
Well, you know, polls consistently have shown, and Kevin, I think we'll have the numbers on this, have consistently shown majorities, even into the 60%, wanting comprehensive immigration reform, including some form of amnesty subject to all the provisions and so on for the 11 million undocumented people in the country. And even, I think, something like a slight majority of Republicans favor that. The Tea Party, it's in the 30s who favor it. So, but so long as the Tea Party rules in primaries, Republicans strike on immigration reform. And you have people like Lindsey Graham saying, look, the voters are going to see this. They're going to see this huge national problem. We're not dealing with it. We may not even want to deal with this supplemental. We may not want to, you know, the president may not even get the money he wants to deal with this crisis. And we're going to look like people who are just passing the buck and being irresponsible. We have to step up to it, he says. Republicans, they don't want to step up to it.
It's a real crisis that we can't do nothing. Maddie in Waupaca, Wisconsin. Maddie, you're on the air.
Hi. I can't help but wonder, you know, what about the Statue of Liberty that welcomed so many people and said, give us your poor, your people yearning to be free? And
also,
I have to wonder if these were white kids, not brown kids, what would the attitude be?
Let us pick it. Nancy, is it a moral blight on this country if we send these kids home, as Jack Beatty suggests? Is it clear?
I don't think it's clear. And in terms of Obama and his interest in taking photographs or going down there, frankly, it's not, and forgive me for being crass, it's not in his political interest to do so.
Why?
Because taking those pictures highlights a problem that there is no clear solution for. And the president doesn't want to talk about a problem he can't solve. He wants to talk about the economy, that the stock market is hovering around 17,000. So I understand the frustration that Kevin spelled out from Texas legislators, but the political advantage of him going down there and taking those pictures is simply not there. And so because of all these complex issues that we've been discussing, I think that's why you don't see him doing that photo opportunity.
But at some point, there's just too much tumult. You got to get on top of it somehow. Mark in St. Louis, thanks for calling, Mark. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Hey,
Hi.
Listen, I think what we ought to do is take all that money, secure the border, stop them at the border, and the right thing to do would be to load these kids up on a C-130 plane, let their family know they're on their way back, and give them a military escort back and make sure they get home okay.
Spend the money on the border, send the kids home. Mark, let me hold that thought and get one more. Maria. Thank you, Mark. Maria in Ashford, Connecticut. Maria, you're on.
Yeah, thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I don't see any difference that President Obama will go to the border or not. Doesn't make any difference. They need to send a strong message to the presidents from Guatemala, Honduras, Salvador, Nicaragua, that they had to do a big campaign to tell the people that stop sending the children. I was born in Guatemala. And the situation is bad. So can you imagine that everybody is going to take the borders and going the train and coming here? And second, they had to change the law, not to tell the people, okay, you had to come to court this date,
yep.
And they go 2 years, 3 years, and the people change states. I mean, I am not against the people that come here, but they come with papers, legal.
It's too much, you say. Maria, we've got it, and I appreciate your call as well. Boy, I don't know, Kevin Diaz, you know, there's Maddie who says we have a moral obligation to help these kids. If they were white children, we'd let them in, we'd take care of them. You hear Mark and Maria saying, we can't do this. They need to go back. A message needs to be sent. Mark says, take the $3.7 billion and secure the border and send these kids home. Would that work, Kevin?
Well, there's a lot of pain and suffering throughout the world. It's just not realistic to say that we're just going to take in everybody anywhere from any quarter of the world who wants to find a better life in the United States. It'd be nice if we could, but I just don't see that as a realistic possibility.
And yet somehow our own back and forth has sent, I mean, there are real problems down there. At the same time, we're sending a message somehow that we don't appear willing to follow through on. I mean, something is also pulling these kids up here. Pam in Austin, Texas. Pam, you're on the air.
Hi.
What do you think, Pam?
My thought is I certainly feel for these children. I do. However, I think that we have a lot of children in our own country that don't have places to live. They don't have food. They don't have adequate health. We live in a fairly affluent area just outside of Austin, Texas, and my own two children are painting together some of their books into five-section spirals, some of their textbooks, because the school district can't afford to replace textbooks. I do feel for these children, but we don't have endless money to rescue every single person in the world, and I feel that we should take care of our own children.
Pam, in Austin, we've got it, and I appreciate your call as well. Kevin Diaz, where do we go here? Textbooks falling apart in public schools there outside Austin. We've got needs at home. But this border situation can't go on in this kind of chaotic tumult. Would comprehensive reform fix this? Is that anywhere in the cards?
Well, presumably, the comprehensive reform bill that passed the Senate last July would have devoted a great amount of resources to the border. I mean, the people
House Republicans said no.
Well, because it was like any big compromise, it was linked to policies that the Republicans don't want, i.e., providing some sort of a pathway to citizenship for people who are already here. This block of 11, 12 million people, whatever it is, already in the United States. This is the way Congress is these days. There's no compromising. There's no meeting in the middle. If there's any aspect of the bill that you can't swallow, you're a no vote. So
we've got to turn. We'll watch the border. It's just heartbreaking politically and practically what's happening there. But it's not the only thing going on in the world this week. Well, all kinds of tension and open conflict. Hear the sound of Israeli missiles exploding in Gaza. And here on Wednesday, Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu blaming Hamas for the escalating violence in Israel and the Gaza Strip.
Today we expanded our operations against Hamas and the other terrorist groups in Gaza. We'll continue to protect our civilians against Hamas attacks on them. Now Hamas, by contrast, is deliberately putting Palestinian civilians into harm's way. It embeds its terrorists in hospitals, in schools, in mosques, apartment buildings throughout the Gaza Strip. Hamas is thus committing a double war crime. It targets Israeli civilians while hiding behind Palestinian civilians.
Netanyahu accusing Hamas of a war crime in New York at the UN Security Council. Palestinian UN observer Riyad Mansour pleaded for UN help.
The Security Council cannot remain paralyzed and marginalized as Israeli war crimes continue against the Palestinian civilian population in the Gaza Strip and in the rest of the occupied Palestinian territory, including East Jerusalem.
Nancy Youssef, everybody's talking war crimes here. At this point, you've got missiles and rockets flying in both directions. Palestinians dying, nearly 100, we're told now. Why is this happening now, Nancy?
A couple reasons. So the reason that we sort of know as we write this is that on June 12th, three Israeli teenagers were killed and a Palestinian killed after that in what appeared to be retaliation. But in terms of the broader context, it comes at a time when Hamas is quite weak because it's now a conflict we've seen in the past in a new region. The allies that it would have depended on in the past, Egypt and Syria, are not there in the way that they once were. And on the Israeli side, you have a far right politic, if you will, that is not lending itself to negotiations, but in fact saying we now have a weak Hamas. This is an opportunity for us to crush them. And so on both sides, you have, if you will, weak changing positions that don't allow for negotiations. And those that would have been in the place to broker peace talks are no longer there. And so all of those elements are coming together such that this week we increasingly heard talks about an escalation, talks about a potential ground war, a second front potentially as rockets started coming in from southern Lebanon, and a much more tenuous situation than we had than a week ago, and very little prospects for someone stepping in and negotiating in the way that it happened just in 2012 in Egypt when Egypt stepped in, and I was there for that, and that political situation is no longer there in Egypt to allow for it. And so both sides see an opportunity to exploit in a way. Hamas wants to portray itself and the Palestinians as victims of Israeli brutality. The Israelis are seeing an opportunity to say that Hamas is seeking to create instability. And most striking is what little condemnation the Israelis have received from the international community, even from the Arab states, in reaction to this. And that certainly speaks to Hamas's weakness in this situation.
At this point, what do the tea leaves signal to you, Nancy? Do you see Israeli forces going on the ground into Gaza? Is it right to call this a war, or what do you call it if they do? And if they do, how long, how deep, with what impact?
Well, those are all great questions. It certainly seems to be that all signals are pointing towards some sort of limited intervention to try to essentially kill as many Hamas members. The value of doing that is that you send a message, if nothing else, that Hamas members who encourage this kind of reaction from their populations, that send rockets over, that the reaction will be direct and immediate to them and to those around them. So that's the sort of incentive of doing some sort of limited intervention. The problem is that there are always unintended consequences with doing such a thing. And again, with nobody there to broker an end to this, there's the fear that we have an escalation of the conflict. And so this is frankly an opportunity for the United States to step in and perhaps try to broker something. Now, whether that's possible or not, we'll see. Remember that the United States does not negotiate with terrorists, and the Hamas is considered a terrorist organization. So it's all very, very precarious. And the next few days are going to be critical precisely because the world is waiting to see whether Israel carries out its promise of a potential ground intervention at a time when it has ruled out any sort of peace talk.
Let's go to Iowa. Pocahontas, Iowa, and Joy. Joy, thanks for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Nice to talk to you. I'm wondering, I think that a lot of Americans don't understand that there is a law called the Leahy Law of the Foreign Assistance Act of 1961, which states that no assistance, I'm reading directly from it, shall be furnished under this act to any unit that commits gross violations of human rights. And I think we give $7 million a day to Israel, and the wall is a violation of human rights. The cutting off of water supply is a violation of human rights, and bombing people that are walled in, I believe, is a violation of human rights. I think that we could do something by saying, look, stop using our bombs to kill children in their homes. It's a frustration to me.
Yeah, we hear it, Joy. They may be going after Hamas fighters, but everybody, the whole world sees also the picture of children. Of course, it's very tight quarters there in Gaza, and no easy way out. Joy, thank you. Susan in Newton, Massachusetts. Susan, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Some of the points I was going to make have already been stated, but they boil down to two pieces of context that are being left out of the discussion.
We've got 1 minute before the break, Susan. Go straight to it.
Okay. First, the context is that the stated goal of Hamas is to get rid of the Jews from the Middle East and establish part of an Islamic state under Sharia law. The second is that people on both sides who want peace are, especially the Palestinian side, there's a much greater percentage of the Israeli public that favors a two-state solution than there is of the Palestinian public.
Yeah, but it hasn't happened. Joy in Iowa sees a human rights violation in Gaza. Do you see a human rights violation there, Susan?
I do, by Hamas, because they purposely embed themselves into civilian areas. They purposely recruit people to be human shields. And this is a tactic that has been used in general for a number of years.
Susan, we're up against the clock right here. I appreciate your call as well. This is On Point. We'll be right back. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. In other news this week, on Tuesday in Washington State, the sale of marijuana became legal. Here, Ellen McCauley, part of a lesbian couple, and this week a legal pot buyer, said the world has changed.
Life has changed so much for us. I wanted to be a part of the new world. So we are married and we are buying legal pot.
A new day indeed. A joke Kickstarter campaign to raise $10 to make potato salad raised more than $70,000. Zach Danger Brown told ABC's Good Morning America he was stunned as the spoof took off.
At day one, we had $200, uh-huh. And I thought that was way too much money. I was overwhelmed at the idea of making $200 worth of potato salad.
And on Tuesday in the World Cup semifinals, catastrophe for soccer-mad Brazilians as Brazil suffered a stunning 7-1 loss to Germany.
Schürrle once again, that's seven! An utter humiliation for Brazil. Just got worse.
And that was it. A week in the news we're looking at here with Nancy Youssef of McClatchy Newspapers, national security correspondent there. Kevin Diaz is with us, Washington correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Jack Beatty's here. A little more on Israel and Gaza. Tal is calling from Boston. Tal, you're on the air. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to provide a little bit of perspective because we're seeing a rerun of what happened in 2012, which was a rerun of what happened in 2009 and so on. And every single time the media asks very good questions, but they're a little bit disconnected. The question here is not what started this round of violence, but rather what is going to end it, and what is going to end it, you know, forever, so that there would be peace. And it's not about the three Israelis that were kidnapped or anything like that. Talking about those things is similar to saying that something in July 2001 caused 9/11, and that's just not true. What's causing this here is that Hamas, and excuse me that my voice is sort of, you know, this is really close to home.
That's okay.
What's causing all of this is that Hamas, on their covenant, on their website, says the goal of our organization is to exterminate the Jews. And there is no what started this until that goes away from the covenant. And
let me ask you why you collect yourself. I understand exactly what you're saying. What about, many people see the flip side of that in so much occupation in the West Bank. You know you've got ultra-Orthodox, right-wing extremists in Israel who imagine that becoming part of Israel. Is that a counterpart? Is that an equal and opposite factor?
Well, thank you for that comparison, Tom. I think that's a very good question. So there's no question that there are people suffering on both sides. And that there's no question that There is something needs to be done about the settlements. A solution needs to be found. I don't want to say what it is, but it's a problem. And I just want to give a perspective as a former soldier in the Israeli military, now a U.S. citizen. I can tell you that in every debriefing, every time a commander is speaking to a soldier, they say, our goal is, first of all, to defend the Israeli citizens, and second of all, to defend the Palestinian citizens. And if we see even one glimmer of hope that something similar to this would happen on the other side, then we can start talking.
You know, Tal, I appreciate your call very much. It's a tough time to observe all this. We've got 100 Palestinians dead, people listing them one by one on our website. I know those rockets have been knocked down going the other way, and lucky for that. But people see that dead Palestinian boy on the other side of those three Israeli teenagers, and it's hard to see it all going one way. Nancy, is there a solution out there somewhere? Can this go on at the same time that the whole region seems to be coming apart?
Well, that's the challenge. I so appreciate what Tal is saying, and I think one of the challenges is that on both sides you have people looking at these kinds of offenses as a final opportunity to rid themselves of their enemy, that Hamas is at their weakest, and on Hamas's side that we have now more sophisticated rockets that can go closer to this cities and we can finally achieve our goals. And I think that's one of the challenges internally to this conflict. It comes at a time when the region is in such turmoil that where this used to be the primary conflict that dominated the discourse in the Middle East, the neighboring countries are all engulfed in their own conflict. For example, in Egypt, where the Egyptian government under Morsi would have come and mm-hmm. defended for their own internal political reasons, they now see this in the prism of terrorism. And at a time when terrorism poses a real threat in Iraq and Syria, once you put things in the context of terrorists versus non-terrorists, then it's hard to sort of have a discussion that looks for moderate solutions, because those who would have led those discussions now see it, frankly, in relative absolute terms, not only to the problems within Israel and the Palestinian territories, but now within their own countries, that one is connected to the other.
Kevin Diaz, do you sense any appetite in Washington to wade in here and try and negotiate an end to this?
One thing I see, having covered presidential politics, is a very strong, and covering Texas in particular, a very strong and rising alliance, or I should say solidarity or sympathy for Israel on the right in this country. People like Ted Cruz and Michelle Bachmann have been louder and louder over the years.
But that's hardly new. I mean, that's been out there for a long time. Where does it take us in terms of, I mean, this is an executive decision, right?
Nowhere. That's the point. It takes us nowhere. And it just solidifies the fault lines here in American politics. But what's interesting about the Middle East right now in terms of American politics is that you've got divisions now even on the right among Republicans about whether to go into Syria or not go into Syria. Remember, some of the people who were oddly overlapping with the Obama administration were the people on the far right, like the Michelle Bachmanns of this world, who didn't want to give any aid to the rebels in Syria because they might be worse than the people who are running Syria now.
Tom, could I just add to that? One of the things we should point out is John Kerry, when he came in as Secretary of State, made one of his core goals to come up with some sort of peace negotiation, was shuttling back and forth.
Yeah. 14 trips in a year, a complete bust.
That's right. And if nothing else, I think the conflict that we're seeing that has played out in the last few weeks really underscores the challenge that was before him, the lack of environment for any sort of real negotiation. And yet, because of the way the environment is in the Middle East now, the United States is perhaps the only broker that can sort of come up with a solution. There's been talk of Qatar and Turkey stepping in, but again, they have their own dynamics that come into play. And so there was an effort by the administration, spearheaded by Kerry himself, to take on this seemingly insurmountable problem. And this week's events, I think, underscore the challenge that confronted him and why he was so unsuccessful on something that he was so committed to trying to bring resolution to.
So many scenes, so hard to watch this week, there, including right there in the Middle East and well beyond. Others that are just confounding. And I want to ask about this one. This was Thursday in Berlin. You had the German Chancellor Angela Merkel talking with reporters for like 2 hours before demanding. This is after the discovery of a couple of very highly placed American spies in the upper echelons of the government of Germany. She demanded the expulsion of the chief American intelligence official stationed in Germany. Here's Merkel. She says, if what is currently discussed corresponds to the facts and a lot is still being investigated, then I simply want to say that looking at it with common sense, in my view, says the German leader, spying on allies is a waste of energy in the end. We have so many problems, I think we should concentrate on the essentials. Nancy Joseph, it seems undisputed here that these were high German officials spying for the United States. This is after earlier revelations of the NSA tapping Angela Merkel's telephone. Is the United States focusing spying attention on Germany? And if so, why? This is supposed to be one of our closest allies in the world.
I don't think they're focusing. I think, on the contrary, Germany is focusing on how much the United States is doing and how many revelations have become public just in the last few months. The expulsion is really unprecedented. It's something you expect between foes, but not between what's supposed to be two very strongly allied nations.
But why shouldn't they be focused on it? Why are we focusing so much on upper echelons? What do we want to know? Isn't Germany an ally? Why would we spy on them so much?
It's a great question, but I think what the Edward Snowden files have revealed is the scope of which the United States conducts the spying on both friends and foes alike. And the reality is that while we talk about allies in this, it happens both ways amongst allies. It's not new to the intelligence community.
Yeah, but this is your beat, and I'm trying to be more specific. What would we be trying to get at? They know something about Russia that we want to know? They know something about energy flow, or what would it be that we'd want to winkle out of Germany? Are we looking for commercial advantage? What would it be?
There's also just what they know about terrorist groups, what they're doing on that. There's a whole element. Remember how
important
Germany is.
Why don't we just ask them?
Well, I think that does happen, but both things, they're not mutually exclusive. One can ask, and also what happens, practically speaking, is spying as well. And it happens on this side as well. And remember how important Germany is. It's the keystone in Europe. It's certainly been the keystone to NATO. And so this is something that happens a lot more frequently than I think is publicly discussed. The fact that Germany is so frustrated speaks to domestically some of their frustration that is happening, and I think a personal frustration on Angela Merkel's part, to the point that you raise, why not approach us directly? Why is it going to tapping into my professional phone calls, sending a 31-year-old in to spy on our intelligence agencies?
Jack Meadey, Americans got pretty upset when Israel was found to be spying in this country years ago. You know, we were all over that. It's not because we said, hey, we're allies. What are you doing? Why shouldn't Germany be upset? Why do you think we're putting so much attention on this, Jack?
Well, according to today's reporting in the Washington Post, there's an absurd sort of link up here with the NSA surveillance program. A German parliamentary committee has been investigating that. And according to the Post, this alleged CIA informant was telling us about what's going on inside that committee. In other words, because of the NSA investigation, we have another spy telling us what's happening inside the committee looking into the NSA investigation. This is a system run amok. And, I'm quoting from the Wednesday's Times, spying case left Obama in dark. The president's call last Thursday called Chancellor Merkel and was talking to her, and the CIA did not tell him that a day earlier, one spy had already been arrested. And he wasn't told that.
So this was already unfolding. This was erupting.
And he was in the dark. Now, he was in the dark about the problems with the Kathleen Sebelius and the website. He was in the dark with the problems around the VA. He has been in the dark around a lot of things. And I just don't quite get what is happening in that administration, just in terms of running the government, of getting things, of telling the president what's going on. And I suspect that a lot of it comes down to that national security team and his chief of staff, Dennis McDonough, whose primary qualifications for that post, so far as I can see, is loyalty to the president, just as Susan Rice's primary qualification seems to be loyalty, just as, again and again, when you look at that, you don't have the A-team in this White House, and what you have is a very loyal team, and the president isn't getting the performance the country deserves.
Kevin Diaz, is that fair? Presidents can't know everything. Should he know everything about what spies are where in every country, Germany included?
Well, I don't know about that. I cover politics, and I think that whatever Angela Merkel just did smacks of politics to me. I'm sure it was done for domestic consumption in Germany. I wouldn't be surprised if it was done even in consultation with the Americans. Spying goes on among countries. It's expected. It's just part of it. It's just the way it is.
Does this weaken us, Nancy, at a moment when Russia has been very problematic? Everybody sees that. Vladimir Putin sort of really pushing his weight around. Germany should be a rock-solid ally in addressing that. Does it create a problem there?
It does in the sense of perception domestically, and in the sense that, that there isn't a feeling of mutual trust, that the relationship is fractured. If to your foes, there's certainly no advantage of being seen before your allies as being fractured and divided and not trusting one another. So in that sense, absolutely does. And to Jack's point about this idea of loyalty and why this wasn't spotted earlier, I think there's an argument to be made that the pattern one sees in this administration is that unless things are not so much micromanaged, but directly dealt with and asked about on a regular basis, that things slip through the cracks. So, for example, the healthcare website, that when sort of left and not asked about directly, the website wasn't working. And as soon as the White House was asking every day about it, suddenly there was a solution. Same thing with the Veterans Administration. Same thing with the spy case. And in the case of our NSA community, it's all very secretive and has become only more secretive. There are secret courts making secret decisions based on information that nobody knows. And so you have those two things where things aren't necessarily being managed in the best way. And it's now being done, in this case, under this huge cloud of secrecy.
Jack Beatty, speaking of things left unattended, how about those vials of smallpox virus? I've got somebody here at the top of the CDC Division of High Consequence Pathogens saying it's sort of the trunk in the attic that no one has looked at for many, many years. You know, it reminds me of the end of Citizen Kane, where they're wheeling that crate into that vast warehouse. And in the middle of it, who knew, back of the closet, the plague.
Oh, God.
Practically.
There it is. Yes, and this follows just a month or so ago, something similar at the CDC in Atlanta, where anthrax was people had to be had a kind of an anthrax scare. Was that bopping around there? You know, again, we want to see the government at least keeping the poisons under some kind of control. I mean, it is I'm looking at a headline. It's 10 o'clock. Do you know where your bubonic plague is?
We hope so. It's kind of a what next week. Let's hope we get on top of some of these things. Nancy Youssef, National Security Correspondent with McClatchy Newspapers. Thank you very much for joining us today, Nancy.
Great to be with you.
Kevin Diaz, Washington Correspondent for the Houston Chronicle. Thank you, Kevin.
Thank you. My pleasure.
And Jack, have a great weekend. Listeners, thanks for joining us. Oh, we go out with a little bit here from, of course, you'll know it if it's your show, Game of Thrones, leading with 19 Emmy nominations this week, including Best Drama. Jack, thanks for joining us. Listeners, thanks for being here. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.